Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Hashi against Ashcroft. Ms. Goldenberg.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Sansari Goldenberg, and I'm here on behalf of Mohammed Abdi Hashi. We are appealing the denial of his application for asylum, withholding of removal, and under the Convention Against Torture. These petitions were denied by the immigration judge Vinicourt and affirmed without opinion by the Board of Immigration Appeals. We're respectfully requesting that the board's findings be vacated and reversed, or the case be remanded for further proceedings. Ms. Goldenberg, I wonder if you could focus for me what, if any, legal errors you think the immigration judge made as opposed to mistaken apprehensions of the fact or credibility, which would obviously carry a quite different standard of review.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I did want to focus quite a bit on the facts, and especially as they relate to the credibility issue. The judge
I mean, I'm not saying you can't argue the fact that that's all you have, but I just want to make sure if there are legal points as well, I don't want them to be lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, his findings of fact are based on legal standards that are not fully that you can't fully support with the facts. For in the issue of the countrywide persecution or the issue of whether the motive of the persecutor is something that should be.
Let me ask you a legal question, counsel.
Yes.
Since, on your view, and I take it the government's view as well, Somalia does not have a functioning government and is indeed in a state of nature.
Correct.
How can one have persecution, since persecution is something governments do or differentially tolerate? I mean, this looks like, on your description, Hobbes's state of nature. It's the war of all against all.
Yes.
But one might think that that's not, as a legal matter, persecution.
The warring factions are warring with each other over control of the government.
There isn't any government.
That's what they're fighting about. Who is in control?
But actually, the fact that there is no government, depending what the Supreme Court thinks,
that's
the Gama
question. Right.
This may not have all bad consequences for you.
Maybe we should ask that question. Are you making any argument that removal to Somalia is never allowed? That's the JAMA question. Your brief doesn't cite JAMA. It's actually quite surprising. This is a Somalia case. Your brief doesn't cite JAMA. The government's case, the government's brief doesn't cite JAMA. This left me with some puzzle.
You know JAMA.
I do know JAMA. Unfortunately, I have not briefed it for this.
But isn't it relevant? I mean, that there's a conflict in the circuits about whether removal
to Somalia
in particular, it's not even like a country with no functioning central government, it's Somalia.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
Is permissible.
Yeah.
So your client is from Somalia, or, you know.
Looking at the facts of this case, the issue in Somalia is that there are still several warring factions, and no place in Somalia at this point is safe for members of these minority clans.
As you describe it, and indeed as everybody describes it in JAMA, no place in Somalia is safe for anyone. It's not that if you were in a different clan, it would be safe for you. No place in Somalia is safe for anyone. Now, of course, that's part of the reason why in JAMA the alien is arguing that no one can be returned. The government is not in control and can't protect anyone.
And I can.
That's one reason why I'm surprised that you are not making an argument based on that theory. Is it one you want to embrace now?
Yes, I would like to.
Yes,
and I can only speak to the facts of this case, where
Let me suggest another line here, since I take it from, in a sense, what you're not saying, that you really don't have any purely legal point aside from what you may now have just embraced under JAMA, but you seem to have said that certain applications of law to fact, what we sometimes call mixed questions, although I don't know whether that helps analysis much, but that may be different. So, for example, the immigration judge says, well, there are areas of Somalia that are settling down, but A, JAMA suggests maybe that's not true, and B, if one looks further at those reports, it seems to turn out that those areas, such as Somaliland, are under the control of a different clan, and thus perhaps just as bad for Mr. Hashi as anywhere else would be. So that might be an application of law to fact that should be questioned further.
Correct, and that is his testimony that he, I don't have the record up here with me, but towards the end of the final set of questions, he does state that he is unable to return to any part of Somalia for exactly that reason, because it is under the control of a different clan, and the judge asked him whether the digital, because the minority clans comprise 30% of the population in Somalia, why couldn't he be protected by any of those clans? But his response is that his clan is just not in power anywhere in the entire area, and he would not be safe.
So Somaliland, for example, is fine for the clan that happens to control it, but not fine for anyone else.
Correct.
Potentially. But what can you do about your credibility point? Since that is, if you read endless immigration cases, that really is something that the judge, the immigration judge, who presides over hearings, has the best opportunity to judge.
Correct, and the judge is accorded substantial deference in the decision regarding credibility, and we acknowledge that. However, the facts that he uses to discredit Mr. Hashi and his testimony and the supporting documents does not go to the heart of the asylum claim. And we believe that they're not, these discrepancies and those cited in the services brief are not relevant and not important to what is actually the issue here. Number one, his testimony is unembellished, and if anything, it's very plain spoken. And as a result of the interpretation that had to go on at that at the hearing, the most difficult.
But he didn't complain at the time. No one complained about the quality of the interpreter. And he was represented, was he not?
Yes.
Yeah. He had a lawyer, and there was an interpreter, and he was. Nobody said to the immigration judge, "Wait a minute, we have a poor interpreter of his language, or somebody who isn't quite in tune with."
Yes, and I don't know that we're necessarily arguing that the interpreter wasn't qualified. My point is that how does an interpreter convey tears, fear, death squads, hopelessness, the shame of a rape that might not even have an adequate description in another language.
But they have to do that all the time, actually. I mean, I don't know if you speak other languages. I mean, some of these concepts are conveyable, even if not quite as vividly, but they certainly are conveyable.
And the other point about the interpreter only is that there were several people speaking at one time. There were interruptions. There was an instance in the record where the interpreter got a word wrong with a cousin versus or daughter versus a wife. And honestly, we don't really know whether there was accurate translations or not. But my point is with this that it's difficult to convey what the horrible things are that you've been through with the use of an interpreter.
Now, do you read Judge Divinicore's decision as simply not believing that this incident occurred when he was 10 years old, when the people barge into the house, and et cetera, et cetera? Or do you believe, or do you think the immigration judge is saying, yes, the incident occurred, but it's not bad enough somehow? It's not sufficiently based to the fact that they were Tunis to count as persecution.
I believe I agree with the second point, the second interpretation, that he does believe that somehow these things were happening because it's fairly these incidents are fairly supportable or are supportable by the 3-inch stack of documents that were submitted with the petition. And
right, and he says actually on page 6, the court finds that the respondent has failed to establish that the attack on his family's house, his brother's alleged killing, occurred due to their Klan membership. So, you know, we don't want to like overdo our reliance on the definite article, but the attack sounds like he thinks that there was an attack, and it's a causation point.
Yes, and he doesn't apparently believe that a 10-year-old could possibly remember that event, but yet paradoxically he expects him to be able to come up with more details in order to support his claim. So we believe that in Mr. Hashi said it's a matter of the trauma that a 10-year-old can certainly remember that kind of an event, and whether he remembers all of the details or not, and certainly the irrelevant ones, like whether they came in militia versus a civilian clothes, or whether or what they said exactly. And I believe the judge kind of a little bit mischaracterizes some of the testimony too. You know, he says that whether he lived in Kismayo for only 2 weeks or the application said 2 months, that distinction is irrelevant because the event happened, and whether they lived there for 2 weeks or 2 months is not really the issue and doesn't speak to the heart of his claim that he lived in fear that the militia would come back. And he did give incredible detail when it came to what his mother told him. And granted, his mother did tell him these things, that his father disappeared and his brother was killed and most of his family members and cousins were raped. So,
when somebody arrives here with false passport and travel documents, is that a basis for an IJ simply discrediting all the testimony that follows? Okay, well, if you're going to lie to get in here, you lie to say anything.
Under established case law, and I apologize, I don't have the exact site right now. I think it might be a matter of OD, which is cited in one of the cases by the service. But the fact that he entered with a fraudulent passport is only relevant to his credibility if it doesn't relate to an essential element of his asylum case, or if it wasn't, let me say it in the reverse. He used the false passport in order to gain entry to the United States, and in his attempt at fleeing this regime. And case law states that it is not something that should be used to impugn his credibility in those kinds of circumstances. And additionally, the false passport is not relevant to his basic claim of asylum. The judge had no issues with his identification and that the fact that he was a CUNY member.
I thought there was an issue that we weren't even sure that this was.
Well, he did find that he is a member of the CUNY clan, and he did question whether he believes he is who he says he is. But I my reading is that he did find or believe that Mr. Hashi is Mr. Hashi from.
Don't you think it's an entirely appropriate inference? Somebody attempts to enter the United States using utterly fraudulent papers, and when he's caught, and only when he's caught, he then tells a different tale. And the inference that it's equally tall is certainly an appropriate one, on my
opinion. That's true, but that isn't what happened in this case. I don't believe his story was ever inconsistent. From the day he entered. And what usually happens in these cases...
Did he claim asylum before the passport fraud was caught?
I did. I think he did. He applied for asylum in Minneapolis.
Not responsive to my question.
Did he...
What is the temporal sequence? Did he apply for asylum? Did he show up? And the first... Basically, the first thing you would have to say to a U.S. official is, I'm seeking asylum. Right? I got on the plane using a fraudulent passport, but I'm not going to submit that in an effort to get into the country. I'm here claiming asylum.
Your brief on page 12 says... He was admitted February 17th. On April 6, 1999, he submits the application for asylum. They reject it, and it's on July 15th he gets the notice to appear.
Right.
I don't know what else I'm supposed to take from that, but it sounds like he asked for asylum before the notice to appear.
He did enter the country. He was allowed in with
the false documents.
Yeah.
But that doesn't, that's not quite the point. But anyway...
Thank you, Ms. Goldenberg.
Thank you.
Ms. Sarko.
May it please the court, my name is Michelle Sarko. I'm here representing the respondents in this matter. Perhaps I can clear up a few things before I get into the merits of the case.
What about JAMA, though? Would you mind addressing
that? Yeah, that's what I was going to. This petitioner would be a member of the class that would be, that the JAMA case will determine.
So in other words, nothing's going to happen to this particular individual until the Supreme Court disposes of the petition that's now granted in JAMA.
That's true. And that's going to be argued in the Supreme Court in October. I think around the 12th or so.
I don't understand class. JAMA is not a class.
No, there is a case in rising out of the Ninth Circuit. It's a nationwide class action. I think it's called Ali. I don't have the site right now, but he's a member of that class and raises the same issue as in JAMA. And so the decision in JAMA will affect that class of which he's a member. So right now we cannot remove him from the United States because there is this injunction that applies to him.
Right, because the Ninth Circuit found that you couldn't. I mean, that created the conflict.
Right, with the Eighth Circuit. Also, I believe he's applied previously for TPS, temporary protected status. There is a question about whether he has renewed that or not, and so that's been extended for those who have applied, but I'm not sure if they have to apply to renew or not. But he might be eligible for that if doesn't presently have it. His attorney, I would expect, would know
about
that.
Could you please raise your voice?
Sorry. His attorney, I would expect, would know about that, whether or not he's applied and is currently eligible for TPS.
I wouldn't make that assumption since his attorney seemed not to be up to speed on Hashim.
Well, the knowledge that I have right now is that he previously applied for TPS. It's just a question of whether he renewed it or not. Okay, I'd like to now address the merits of the case, if I might. This case involves an alien from Somalia who came to the United States in 1999 using his false passport and who lied to immigration inspectors about his identity.
Right, and of course he was in a position where he probably couldn't have gotten a valid passport because Kenya was certainly not going to give him one.
Right,
and
well,
Kenya's busy exporting Somalis who have gone there, and Somalia is, as Judge Easterbrook put it, in a state of nature, so it's hard to know where the passport office
right.
is.
Right, and it's not so much that as that when he arrived in the United States, he could have then immediately applied for asylum.
But could you perhaps clarify, because it looks to me from the sequence in his brief, that he in fact presented himself to the INS before anybody was coming after him. This says April 6, 1999, he submits the form I-589 for the Nebraska Service Center.
I do not know, as between that, whether they red flagged him or whether he first submitted the asylum. I'm willing to accept that
well,
he first
the note,
submitted
okay.
asylum.
All right.
But the point is that...
forward.
The point is that he gained admission to the United States by lying, and he could have immediately asked for asylum. Instead, he gain admission sometime thereafter he applied for asylum. And I think in that scenario, that in conjunction with all the other evidence that's in the record drawing to question his reliability of his testimony.
Well, but you know, what other evidence is there? The immigration judge had for me a bizarre notion of what 10-year-olds are capable of remembering. I don't know about you, but I remember all sorts of things from when I was in fifth grade and 10 years old, particularly notable things, like when my fifth grade teacher embarrassed me one day in class. And that was, of course, utter trivia compared to what happened.
Well, I don't think that the immigration judge necessarily was challenging his household was attacked or that his father
disappeared. See, that's what I can't tell, because on the one hand, I certainly can read parts of his opinion the way you've just decided. But then, if you look at footnote 1, he says, he's talking in particular about the alleged statement where the men said that they were there basically because he was Toonie. The veracity of this statement is extremely doubtful, and he says, you know, maybe he plagiarized. And then he also has a footnote later on page 6, footnote 3, where he says, he concludes, given these facts, the court finds the respondent's recollection of what occurred when he was 10 years old unreliable and suspect. So I don't know what the words "what occurred" refer to. Do they refer to the whole incident? Do they refer to particular details of the incident? If so, which ones?
Well, I think addressing the first footnote, I think there he's specifically talking about the statements that he claims that the intruders made when they came to the house as to why they were there and doing what they were doing.
Right. How can he, from what would he draw such an inference? Because it seems to me in all of these very sorry instances we've seen over the last decade or so of ethnic cleansing, the cleansers, if you will, are more than happy to say, you know, you're a dirty Bosnian or you're a dirty X or a dirty Y. I don't know why that's inherently unbelievable, and the fact that this is happening in a lot of cases is equally consistent with A, plagiarism, or B, the fact that Somalia is a terrible place and it's actually happening to everyone, and thus there's a certain repetitiveness in the stories. How can we tell?
Well, I think the question is, well, it's a twofold thing. Let me first address, I don't think it's unreasonable for the immigration judge to think that a 10-year-old can't specifically remember if he's not consistent in the rest of his testimony as to what was said as to why they were there, that they would come in and the first thing they announced
is
we're here because you're Toonie and we're Hawari and therefore you have to get out of here and you shouldn't be here and we're going to...
And why would not a 10-year-old remember that? Do you think during the period of the Holocaust, you know, a 10-year-old Jewish boy would have not been aware that the Nazis were there because he was Jewish?
Well, the question is, what did they say? Does he remember what they say, or does he remember something that someone told him later?
Why?
Or,
well, okay.
And we also have to think about, it was 8 years between the time that these events allegedly occurred.
Why would that memory fade? Again, you know, given the analogy, say, to the Holocaust period, wouldn't that be one of those memories you'd keep with you?
Not necessarily.
When your lung is collapsed and you're beaten up and you're...
Well, the exact statements, not necessarily. Maybe what people, you know, told you and repeatedly thereafter, or what you read somewhere
else. Is there any evidence in this record about what children do remember, or indeed any evidence in the published literature about what children do remember? And it seems better to refer to that than to have a pack of lawyers talking off the top of their heads.
I have to confess, I did not look for such cases when I was briefing. Perhaps I should have. But the other point is,
the immigration judge did not reveal the scientific basis for his beliefs, and of course neither side's brief discusses any psychological literature.
It was not. You have to also look at the other things in the case. He was very specific as to that, but he couldn't remember. He said, well, they came in, they stole stuff, but I don't remember what.
But don't you think that's exactly, I mean, Judge Easterbrook is right. There are such studies that as a matter of common experience, people do remember things that are more personal to them, probably more than they remember, you know, whether it was a bowl or a vase that got stolen. What I'm curious about as well is I don't know, the whole question of excluding a hypothesis in other areas, for example, antitrust. You know, if a fact is there which is equally consistent with explanation A and explanation B, you need something else before you know which direction to go in. You need evidence that tends to exclude one of the hypotheses. And I'm concerned that this record doesn't have that kind of evidence.
If I might, there are other things in here that also question his reliability. For instance, his testimony as to how the people were dressed. In his asylum application, I think.
Why is that a crucial fact?
Well, it goes to the credibility, and if he's going to remember who these people are, his memory as to what was said, what the circumstances of what happened. If someone's reading you, and one thing you're saying, asylum application, you're saying that it was plain clothes, and his testimony is saying it was military fatigues, I might have that reversed. But, I mean, that's something that would stick in your mind. As
maybe.
Well, and he, yeah. You know, it's inconsistent there. It's very inconsistent with regard to when he went to Kismayu. The asylum
Let me go back to the immigration judge's opinion, which is actually what we're reviewing.
Right.
Because if it's internally inconsistent, if, for example, it's hard to tell, as I find it a bit hard to tell, whether Judge Vinokur is rejecting his account that an incident occurred that would be, if one believed it, persecution, or if Judge Vinokur is just finding that certain facts on the edge may or may not have occurred, that would make a big difference, because if this incident did occur the way he describes it, it seems to me it easily satisfies the definition of past persecution. But if it didn't, you know, we need to know, you know, what did the judge find, and therefore we go from there.
He clearly found that it wasn't on account of.
He seemed to think that it was really just because people wanted their own militias. I wasn't sure what that fact had to do with anything, actually.
Well, I don't remember him quite saying that. I think he found that it occurred because people wanted the land and came through and looted the houses, and that was the reason that they came south from Mogadishu to control the area. And they wanted the land, and they looted the houses routinely as they moved south.
Did he find out who they were? Did the immigration judge make a finding as to who was in the group that was trying to push out
the Hawari?
The Tuni. So he does have the finding,
well,
but it's the Hawari, and he agrees that Hashi is a Tuni clan member. He makes that finding.
He makes that finding based on the testimony of the one other
witness. But he makes the finding, right? Yeah. So we don't need to...
I'm not disputing
right.
that.
Okay.
Yeah. As I was saying before, there's a big inconsistency with regard to Kismayu. In his asylum application, he says that they moved there from Koraoli, and they were there for several months, and then... that almost routinely that I can't remember their name, the group that attacked them there came like, you know, once a week. Now that's a big difference from his testimony where he said that they went down there and they were only there for 2 weeks, and that on this one occasion they came and attacked them. Subsequently they left. That's a huge discrepancy.
Could I just focus you on page 6 though, because you just said that the court does find that it was the Hawari who attacked him. And on page 6 of the immigration judge's opinion,
okay.
He says he's criticizing Hashi's account, and he says he's criticizing the account that they were being attacked because they were members of a minority clan without a militia to protect them. The court finds this assertion far-fetched and not believable. Further, he claims he knows the attacks, et cetera, all occurred at the hands of rival clans because his mother told him so. I don't know. Maybe that isn't a way of saying I don't think it was the Hawari, but
No, I think what he was saying is he didn't believe the statements that the petitioner testified that these men said when they entered the house. That he didn't believe his memory, and he thought that basically he was embellishing.
So all occurred at the hands of rival clans really just refers to conversation, not the identity of the attackers?
You're saying that the...
I'm just trying to figure out what he's saying.
I'm trying to
find
the sentence.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's in the middle of the first full paragraph on page 6. He knows it all occurred at the hands of rival clans because his mother told him so, and the court goes on to basically say, I don't think that's reliable.
Right. He doesn't believe that's reliable.
So I thought that meant he wasn't sure if it was Hawari or not. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think he's talking about the on account of. I don't think he's necessarily challenging that the people who were attacking were Hawari, or the people they were attacking were the Darods in the other instance. I think it's the on account of that he has a problem with. And his belief is that they were just civil war, and it was a group that was sweeping through the region, and they were pushing out and attacking people that were there, looting their houses to get control of the region. I think I'm going to sum up, if you don't mind. The thing that this court has to keep in mind
is
that...
Thank you very much. Case taken under advisement.